Hymns, John. Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda. Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda. Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. So it's August 2nd, 2012 in Los Angeles, and we're reading from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhulila, Chapter 13, The Lord's Dancing at Ratiyatra. Text 61. Saksate na deya deka parokshe tadaya ke bhujite pare Chaitanya Chandraramaya. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Although the king was refused an interview, he was indirectly bestowed causeless mercy. Who can understand the internal potency of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? Purport. As Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was playing the part of a world teacher, he did not agree to see the king because a king is a mundane person interested in money and women. Indeed, the very name king suggests one who is always surrounded by money and women. As a sannyasi, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was afraid of both money and women. The very word king is repugnant to one who is in the renounced order of life. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu refused to see the king, but indirectly, by the Lord's causeless mercy, the king was able to understand the Lord's mysterious activities. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's activities were exhibited sometimes to reveal him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So here Prabhupada is explaining Lord's mysterious activities. He's explaining there are two types. So Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's activities were exhibited sometimes to reveal him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead and sometimes to show him as a devotee. Both kinds of activity are mysterious and appreciated only by pure devotees. Although the king was refused an interview, he was indirectly bestowed causeless mercy. Who can understand the internal potency of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? So this may seem very strange, mysterious, the Lord's activities as a devotee, that on one level, he says, no, I can't see the king, he's a materialist. And on another level, he loves the king and he gives him his mercy and he recognizes him as his devotee. And both of those things are going on at the same time. So this may be very mysterious. One might focus on one more than the other or not be able to reconcile the two. And we may ask, especially those of us in Srila Prabhupada's Hare Krishna movement, well, why didn't he agree to see the king altogether? I mean, we regularly see materialistic people, right? Anybody here never see materialistic people? I mean, I see one in the mirror every morning, but in addition to that, I mean, I know a few devotees who never leave temple property. There's one pujari at Bhaktivedanta Manor. I think he's left the property only twice in 40 years. But even so, materialistic people come to the manor. You can't avoid it. So why was... And anyway, the king wasn't a materialistic person, Maharaj Prataparudra. He wasn't interested just in sex and money. He was a bhakta. He was actually became pure devotee, very elevated bhakta. So why wasn't he seeing the king? At the same time, he would see the king. So here we see that the Lord is interested in different levels of dharma. And he's interested in all of those levels. So just like I used to run a school, and in the school we had from kindergarten through 12th grade. And as the head of the school, I was interested in all of the levels. I wanted to make sure the 5-year-olds had the proper instruction and the 15-year-olds had the proper instruction. And that instruction was going to be different. So you tell the 5-year-olds that you can't subtract a larger number from a smaller number, correct? Okay. So if you're 5 or 6 and you try to do 3 minus 5, you say, no, you can't do that. In fact, I used to tell the children until they were 7, never start a sentence with the word because. If they started a sentence with the word because, they'd write a fragment. But when they're older, you can tell them that you can indeed subtract 3 minus 5. People do it all the time. It's called credit cards. Right? And you can set a you can start a sentence with the word because, as long as you put your main clause, your independent clause, second. But if you tell that to the little children, they'll become confused. So I recently had some exchange with one devotee who's recently taken up Krishna consciousness, and she was saying she used to be a very devout Christian, and she said that she used to try to convert all of her old Christian friends to Krishna consciousness. And then she realized that she was actually harming them. So I had the same experience many years ago when I was foolishly discussing with some devotees who thought that the Hare Krishna movement was only and solely and totally about Varnashram, and that Varnashram is only and solely and totally about women never leaving the kitchen. So I was talking to them about the fact that Krishna consciousness includes Varnashram certainly, but goes beyond that, and Varnashram has something to do with things other than whether or not women ever take a step outside the kitchen. What happened was I started to become successful with one or two people at shaking their beliefs. And then I could understand that if I was successful, I would harm them rather than help them. So this is explained very nicely by Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Niyamagraha section of Bhaktiloka, where he talks about how there's different regulations at different stages. And one should not perform the regulations at the stage either below one's level or above one's level. So often in the Hare Krishna movement, we stress don't go above your level, but equally one should not go below one's level. And one needs to give instruction on an individual basis for what's appropriate to a particular person's level. Just like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, don't disturb the minds of the ignorant. So if you go to people who are at a particular level and you give them instructions that are too high for them and you shake them from where they are, instead of pulling them up, they may simply fall down. So I understood these two devotees I was talking to that if they gave up their attachment to Varnashram, they would simply go into sinful life. They wouldn't go higher. They weren't ready to go higher. So it was better to just leave them alone. A similar thing happened with Mahaprabhu with Ramananda Roy in South India, where as soon as the Lord saw Ramananda Roy, both Ramananda Roy and Mahaprabhu were in ecstasy, and they were embracing each other. But there were all these caste brahmanas there, and they saw what was going on, and they thought, what's happening? Why is this sannyasi embracing a kayasta? That's not proper. And Mahaprabhu could understand that people had this mentality, and so he desisted. And he talked to Ramananda Roy privately later. Because the Lord is interested also in maintaining the lower levels. The lower levels are not unimportant. Certainly in and of themselves, the lower levels, the sub-religious principles, just by themselves, they don't have any value. If you follow the sub-religious principles, I mean, you can be an atheist. You can be a vegetarian, celibate, you know, teetotaler, non-gambler atheist. You can even be a moral atheist, and then you can go to the subterranean heavenly planets with all the other moral atheists. I have a place for them. Kind of like a cosmic Las Vegas. The sun never shines there. It's all artificial light, you know. They don't even know that time has passed. They do that in Las Vegas, you know. They put in perfume to the gambling casinos so that you stay awake and you gamble 24 hours. So on the subterranean heavenly planets, there's no sun. They have no idea that time is passing. Now they have only artificial light from jewels, a little better than neon lights. And there's no devotees there to disturb them. And they don't go to the actual heavenly planets of Indra where everybody's engaged in Sankirtan. So you can be a moral atheist. The sub-religious principles alone, they're not enough. Necessary, but not sufficient, just to be a good person. But yet, without being a good person, coming to transcendence is very difficult. It's possible. Magrari came immediately to transcendence without first being a good person. Who else did that? Valmiki, yeah. Anybody else who went immediately to transcendence from being a low-class, sinful person? Adamiel, yeah. Jagai and Madai, maybe many of us. So it's certainly possible to go directly from sinful life to transcendence. You don't need to go up through the yoga ladder, as described in the 12th chapter by Bhagavad Gita. Yoga ladder is first, you're a good karmi. You follow varnashram. Then you come to karma yoga, where you're still following varnashram, but you're doing it for personal purification. Then you come to gyan yoga. We're interested in merging with the Brahman. And then from that, you can go to dhyan yoga, where you're interested in the paramatma. And from there, you can come to bhakti. Actually, Krishna says, Tlesho dikataraschteksham avyakta, shaktatechasam avyakta, higatir dukam dehavadbir vapite. He doesn't even recommend that slow path. What to speak of now in Kali Yuga? How are you going to get people to perfectly follow varnashram? It's going to be a little difficult. So it's not that one has to go that way. Although it's a fact that Krishna explains in the Gita that those who were pious in previous lives and in this life, they can easily take to devotional service with determination. And anyway, it's so much nicer even for the devotees if everybody was pious. Wouldn't we like it if all of the milk in the stores was from protected cows? Right? And was no animal slaughter going on and no gambling and I mean, it would be nicer for us too, wouldn't it, if the society was pious. So the Lord is concerned with material piety, although it's mundane. He's concerned with it as a stepping stone for transcendence. He's concerned with it because it makes transcendence easier. He's concerned with it because generally the devotees are also interested in following, not always, the externals of material piety. At the same time, that's not all that he's interested in. Mahaprabhu is not interested only in the kindergarten class. He's also interested in the MIT PhD program. So he wants to do both at the same time without either disturbing the other. So he's on one level saying, I'm a sannyasi, I don't associate with materialistic person. And on another level saying, I'm a bhakta, you're a bhakta. And what is there other than sadhu sangha? How wonderful to be in the sangha of my devotees, in the mood of the Lord, and how wonderful to be in the sangha of other devotees, in the mood of a devotee. So these activities of the Lord are very mysterious, because someone on the lower level, they can't understand, why is he seeing the king in the garden? Why is he hugging Ramananda Roy? You know, why does he associate with Sikhi Mahiti's sister? So why on one level does he engage in a realm that's transcendental? And sometimes those on the higher platforms are saying, well, why is the Lord concerned with this mundane morality? But he wants to preserve both. Let's just look for a minute at each of them here. So as far as on the level of mundane morality, why doesn't a sannyasi want to associate with a materialistic person? And here Prabhupada's talking about that the king, we don't see very many kings, so we may not really understand this, but that the king is the epitome of a materialistic person. I think in modern society, who would be the epitome of a materialistic person? Not kings. We don't have any. Movie stars? CEOs? Rock stars? Athletes? So basically, the leaders of the Vaishyas and the leaders of the Shudras, they tend to be the ones in our, we don't really have leaders of Kshatriyas in our modern society. We've tried to arrange it so that the top Kshatriyas don't have much access to money and sex, isn't it? We've tried to take that away from them. And it's simply, that facility's simply gone down to the next Varnas. So those are the people that are likely to have, you know, millions and millions or billions of dollars and, you know, some sports person who's paid millions for every game and bragging about, oh, I've had affairs with 20,000 women. It was some basketball star, I think, who said that. So this is their general mode of life. So why doesn't a sannyasi want to associate with such persons? Some idea? And maybe some contamination. Especially there's a particular kind of contamination that a person in the renounced order is concerned about. And we saw this also with Raghunath Das Goswami. And the story of Raghunath Das Goswami confused me for a very, very long time. So he was from a very wealthy family. The materialistic people were his own family members. Although they were Vaishnavas. They were called Prakriti Vaishnavas. I mean, they were Vaishnavas. They were facilitating Haridas Thakur, for example. But they didn't want Raghunath Das Goswami to surrender to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we may have found this even in our own families. That, I mean, I remember my mother saying to me, it's fine if you want to be religious, but don't be extreme. You know, just, you can go worship every once in a while. You know, finally she gave up on that one and said, well, if you're going to be extreme, why can't you do it in our own faith? And then my sister did that, and she became very self-righteous. And my mother said, okay, you're okay where you are. But that general mood, and you see it, you know, whether your parents are Christians or Jews or Hindus, this idea of religion is fine, just don't take it too far. Don't surrender everything. Don't give up everything. Have a balanced life. You know, and those of us in the old days who moved into the ashrams and, you know, maybe we brought our toothbrush and our toothpaste kind of thing and lived in a room with 20 other people and, you know, it was a little difficult for my mother. What's your daughter doing? Oh, she's selling Hindu books in the New York subway. You know, it was a little... My parents were from a very wealthy aristocratic family, and it was a little difficult for her. She didn't become favorable till we bought a house. You know, she could say, oh, they have a house and a car. And then she decided Krishna consciousness wasn't so bad. So Raghunath Das Goswami's family was something like that. They were Vaishnavas, but like, you know, be pious, but don't make it your whole goal of life. So when he finally ran away, went to Jagannath Puri, and his father found out where he was, his father was sending him money. And at first, Raghunath Das Goswami was using that money to host Mahaprabhu, I think it was twice a month, pay for him to have a nice meal. And then after, I believe it was 2 years, he stopped accepting the money. So I couldn't understand, why would he stop accepting the money? Is it reasonable to say that most of us, if we were given a lot of money, we would accept it? So why did he reject it? I couldn't understand it. Then finally I ended up in a temple that was being heavily subsidized by a very wealthy person. And then I understood, oh, that's why he didn't take the money. What happened was this very wealthy person was paying salaries to everybody who worked in the temple, and he was at a distant place. So the people running the restaurant, people running the gift shop, they got a salary from this wealthy person at a distant place. And the salary had nothing to do with their performance. It didn't even have anything to do with their engagement in sadhana. So I started seeing the people getting the salary. They would come to the temple at 9:30 or 10 in the morning. And pretty soon everything started falling apart. And I said, oh, that's what happens. And later on I also saw when I was working on curriculum that I had some wealthy persons who said, oh, we're going to give you $500,000, which they never gave me. Anyway, they promised they were going to give me $500,000. And I saw that when somebody does that, you have a tendency to start serving them instead of Krishna and Prabhupada. It's a strong tendency. Oh, this person's going to give me $500,000. Let me please them. You forget Bhakti Ramya Gatapasam is Krishna, and you start thinking Bhakti Ramya Gatapasam is this rich person. You start molding yourself to their mentality. So it's not just that you can become contaminated in the sense that you'll hang out with the person and maybe you'll start doing the same things that they're doing. But it's also a very subtle kind of contamination. That you start getting the wrong master. So Srila Prabhupada says in this Nectar of Instruction about being very careful to take charity from materialistic people. He talks about where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, if you eat grains cooked by materialistic people, your mind becomes wicked. And he talks also about taking money from materialistic people. And he says that not everyone can use anyone's contribution to further the Krishna consciousness movement. So the standard used to be in Mahaprabhu's time to be very, very, very careful not to associate with materialistic persons. The Brahmins in general, what to speak of the renunciates, they didn't want to put themselves in a position of dependence on the Kshatriyas or the Vaishyas, or today it would be the Shudras. Just like the modern Brahmanas, the modern scientists and researchers, most of them are firmly in the pocket of business. You all know that, right? I remember many, many years ago in the Gurukula, we had one documentary about how a lot of the people who do research for pharmaceuticals are being paid by the drug companies. So they end up saying, oh, this drug works great. This drug cures you. This drug does that, and it's all a sham. So as soon as those who are supposed to be the protectors of truth, as soon as they are under the control of those who are the protectors of people or those who are the protectors of the natural resources and the animals, they're going to compromise truth. That's the risk. So Mahaprabhu wanted to set an example, not even to see. We find the Lord often sets this very extreme example, not just, I don't want to be under with the salary of. You know, it wasn't just, okay, I don't want the king paying my salary. I don't want to be supported by the king so that I might be compromised. I don't even want to see the king. Of course, the Lord as Ramachandra also set such a heavy example. Right? Prabhupada refers to this in Bhagavatam chapter 8 in the teachings of Queen Kunti, where she has to sever her tie of affection for her kinsmen, the Pandavas and the Vrishnis. And Prabhupada talks about that the devotee has to widen their tie of affection, that cutting off the affection for the family means I see the world as my family. It doesn't mean you become hard-hearted. And he talked about to be a devotee, to be a brahmana, to be a king, one has to have such expanded affection. And he gave the example of Lord Ramachandra, who exiled his wife, his pregnant wife, for the sake of serving the whole society. So such an extreme example, to exile your pregnant wife just because someone criticized her unfairly. But that concept, so Mahaprabhu is also showing this concept, don't even want to see. If I see, I may enter into a relationship. If I enter into a relationship, then I may start taking favors from the person. I may become compromised. And then my ability to speak truth will be gone. Or other people may even think like that. Oh, that's sannyasi. He's good buddies with the king. How can we believe anything that he says? Now, who knows what their private dealings are? Everything had to be open. Everything had to be transparent. So, of course, that's a very high standard. Most of us at the present time would feel very nervous about making every aspect of our life transparent, perhaps. But Mahaprabhu was like that to a very extreme degree. But he's also to an extreme degree as a devotee. So he's also acting above these principles of mundane dharma. This is not a king. This is not somebody who's a materialist, who's trying to control the world through money and who's controlled by his women. That's not who this is. This is someone who's a lover of God. This is someone who's a Vaishnava, who I want to be with. But I want to be with in such a way that I'm not going to be criticized. So from the point of view of the king got the Lord's mercy in a way that he didn't expect. So I'm sure this happens to us also. You know, every day, hopefully, at least once a day, if not many, many, many times during the day, hopefully at every moment, we're asking the Lord for his mercy. Every time we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're saying, please engage me in your service. Please give me some service. Please give me some service. Please be merciful to me. Although, as Krishna is part and parcel, Mama Vamso Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, in one sense we have a right, dayabak, like the child has a right to inherit the kingdom of God for service. But in another sense, we took that birthright and we, as in the biblical story, exchanged it for a bowl of oatmeal. All of material enjoyment could be compared to a bowl of oatmeal. Even the best oatmeal isn't great, and the bowl runs out. So we took our inheritance of loving service to Krishna, we exchanged it for some oatmeal, even if it has cinnamon and maple syrup in it. And now we want our service back. So just like if somebody has offended us, and then they want to come back into our association, so they can't just assume. Isn't that true? Anybody ever cheat you and then want to be your friend again? Anybody have that experience? Or cheat you really badly? And then they say, oh, can I be your friend again? You're like, well. So it's like that. We're begging for mercy. And we should be assured, Asabandha, we should be assured that we're going to get that mercy. Of course we're going to get that mercy. What parent will not take back their child? Not possible that we won't get that mercy. But it may come in a way that's very different from what we expect. So Maharaj Pratapuruta never got Mahaprabhu's mercy in an open way. He never became one of Mahaprabhu's associates in a way that was obvious to everyone. But at the same time, he became a close associate. So we may find that also. We're saying, Krishna, give me service. Krishna, give me service. Krishna, take me back. Take me back. O Srimati Radharani, please ask Krishna to take me back. I want to serve you again. And I'll behave. And then, of course, we don't behave. And then we come back and say, I really will behave. And then again, we don't behave. And we come back and we say, but this time I'm really going to behave. And then we find that there's times in our life when we're given this incredible mercy. I remember tasting the prasadam and we say, wow, what is this? Just like what Chaitanya said. These are all ordinary ingredients. What is this taste? Or we're in the kirtan and we say, what is this experience? Or we're reading Prabhupada's books and say, wow, look at that sentence. That's amazing. And there are so many times we get that mercy, but it may not be when we expect or where we expect or how we expect. It may be in a very different way. We might think, oh, well, let's see, if I go to Vrindavan and Kartik and chant 120 rounds a day, then I'll get mercy. But maybe you're going to get mercy in the subway distributing books instead. Or one very senior devotee in the movement said, I really started entering into higher realms of bhakti on an airplane flying over the United States. So who knows? Mahaprabhu gave him mercy through the king's son, through giving him a piece of cloth, and in the garden. And the king was in disguise. And he gave him mercy here at the Rath Yatra, that the king was one of the few people who could see that Mahaprabhu was dancing simultaneously in all seven parties. It was very private mercy, wasn't it? It was just something from within him. And the devotee is happy however Krishna wants to show his mercy. The devotee doesn't make some demand. How can we make any demand anyway when we're such rebellious rascals? At least me, I don't know. Maybe none of you are rebellious rascals. How can we make any demands? How can we say, you must show me mercy, or you have to show me mercy like this, at this time, in this way? But rather the devotee sing, King Prajaparudra, he sing. Mahaprabhu has his purpose. He has his mood. He has his mission. And two things are going on at the king at the same time. I have to see the Lord. If I don't see the Lord, I'm going to give up my kingdom and travel with one earring as a mendicant. Remember that? I'm going to give up everything. And the devotees told the Lord, you know, that would be terrible because Maharaj Pratapuruja is doing a really good job of running the kingdom and keeping the Muslims out and protecting Lord Jagannath. And at the same time, King Prajaparuta can understand, however the Lord wants to show me his mercy is perfect. Even if I don't understand what the Lord's intentions are, I mean, we're talking here about the Lord's intentions, that he wants to uphold the various levels of Dharma simultaneously. But I may not always be able to understand the Lord's intentions. Here, mysterious, Prabhupada says. Who can understand why Krishna does what he does? Who of us with our little brain, I mean, we may think that we have a big brain, but compared to Krishna, we have a very little brain. You know, we can't even understand, even things on this earth planet, we can't even understand. What to speak of the universe, what to speak of Krishna. When Lord Brahma saw all of the cowherd boys and the calves turn into Vishnu forms, and he said, other people may say they can understand you, but for me, I don't understand you. And he's got four brains. You know, he created the whole universe, and he can't understand. How am I going to understand? So some trust that if I keep surrendering to Krishna, I keep chanting Krishna's name, and I keep serving to him, he will show me his mercy. He will take me back home. He loves me. He wants me to come home. What did Prabhupada say? We take one step towards Krishna, he take 10 steps towards us. Any of us who are parents, we know that we want a relationship with our children often more than they want with us. Just the way it is. The child may forget the parent never forgets the child. So Krishna is anxious to have us back. He is going to show us his mercy, but he's going to show us his mercy in his own way, in his own place, in his own time. Because he has a universal plan. And we trust. However, sometimes he shows us mercy by humiliating us. I was just right now studying the chapter of Bhishma Dev's leaving, and Bhishma Dev is talking about the tribulations suffered by the Pandavas and Kunti. They were the best friends of Krishna, who was right there standing next to them. And Prabhupada said, so how should we expect there's no tribulations? And Prabhupada makes an incredible statement. I'm not going to remember it word for word. Something about that the tribulations are part of the reciprocation of the bhav between the Lord and the devotees, because then the Lord gets to save his devotees. He gets to play the hero. So that's the mood of the devotees. However you want to have me in your service, you want to have me in your service by setting an example that I'm a materialist you can't talk to. Okay. For Bhishma, you want me to be in your service by having me fight on the wrong side and lose. Okay. You want to have me be in your service by having me be in a gambling match and lose my intelligence. So much that I gamble away my brothers and even my wife. Okay. Whatever role you want me to play, even if it means you're going to crush me, you're going to humiliate me, if that will aid your lila and aid your purposes, then I accept. But I have one request, that I be connected with you in service. That's the mood of the devotee. That you please always show me your mercy by manifesting yourself in my heart. The devotee always wants to be in internal samadhi and wants their activities to be pleasing to the Lord. Well, someone else may criticize, someone else may not criticize. And how do we get that mercy? Especially as Maharaj Prajaparudra, how did he attract the Lord's attention? Through humility. And for a king like Prajaparudra, sweeping the road was an extreme sign of humility. Again, we may not relate to this in the West, but in India, the street sweepers are really low. They're called untouchables. They're literally untouchable. Nobody wants to touch them. We don't really have an outcast in America. We don't even officially have castes. I mean, we do have castes, but we pretend that we don't. We like to pretend that we're all equal and that we have just a merit-based society. Well, none of that's true, but anyway. So we don't have any official outcasts, although we have them, for sure. But at least in India, in the time of Maharaj Prajaparudra, the person who physically swept the street, they were the most low. And someone who was very aristocratic would never do such a thing. We've had some experience at one of our schools in India. where some of the teachers are from caste Brahmin families. And we had one of our ISKCON devotees come in to train the teachers. So our ISKCON devotee said, you know, you should make sure the classroom is clean. If you notice it's dirty, you know, you can take the broom and sweep. And these caste Brahmin teachers were so offended that the ISKCON devotee was asked to leave the school and not come back. So what to speak of, you know, you're the big king. You don't sweep the road. Someone else sweeps the road for you. You don't even walk on the road. Like the demigods, their feet don't touch the ground. You know, they can't be lowered to that level that I'm going to touch the earth. Of course, Brahma, his feet touched the ground when he offered obeisances to Krishna. But generally, the demigods, their feet don't touch the ground. I was just remembering that story with Srila Prabhupada, where the reporters asked him if he could fly in a magic carpet. And then they asked Prabhupada why he was flying on an airplane, and Prabhupada said, to be one with you. So, you know, normally the king, he's not going to even walk on the road. He's not going to just walk down the street. He's going to be riding on an elephant or carried in a palanquin or in a fancy chariot. What to speak of, be sweeping the street. But Maharaj Pratiparudra was in the mood that I may be officially the king, but that's my service. And the real king is Jagannath. I'm just a little servant of a little kingdom on a little planet in a little universe. And Mahaprabhu was so happy to see not just the service mood, but a service mood demonstrated through menial service. So if we really want to attract the mercy of the Lord, which may come in all kinds of forms and all kinds of ways at all kinds of places, to take up some menial service. Menial service means a service that maybe nobody even notices. It's like I don't know if she's here anymore, the devotee whose room we're staying in told me that she comes 2 weeks early to set up the boutique at the Rath Yatra. And I was thinking, I never realized that setting up a boutique at Rath Yatra took 2 weeks' work worth of prior work. You know, all the little background work, scrubbing the pots, right? The work that nobody sees. Something in your own room or the back room or maybe you're not getting enough sleep. You're working even when you're sick. It's the kind of work nobody ever gets up in front of the temple room and gives you a garland or a maha plate for. I remember really noticing that on 55th Street during the Christmas marathon. So I guess my daughter was probably about maybe a year old then. So I was going out almost full time on the marathon. And I was getting some prizes, you know. So Armila distributed 600 BTGs, you know, and I go up to the front and I get a big maha plate. And then after the marathon was over, nobody said, Armila changed 5 poopy diapers today. Never got an award for that. I'm still waiting for it. But to take up some kind of menial service like that. Menial service forces us, if we want to be happy, to remember Bhoktaram Yagatapasam. That we're sacrificing for Krishna because nobody else is going to ever appreciate it or reciprocate with it. When we do the kind of service where we get appreciation and reciprocation from other jivas, it's easy to forget that Krishna is the real object of sacrifice. And it's easy to forget that we're really a little tiny service, a little tiny servant. But at least sometimes, I mean, even if Krishna is giving us some big front-of-the-room service to do like he gave to Maharaj Pratiparudra, at least sometimes, you know, go in the back and wash the pots and scrub down the kitchen and change the poopy diapers and something that no one's going to see, no one's going to know, no one's going to appreciate. Because who appreciates that? Krishna. Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hridayesha Junatisthiti. So here we're looking from the point of view of the Lord, that he wants to uphold both ordinary sub-religious principles, ordinary dharma for the sake of a peaceful, sane society, and a launching pad for bhakti. And he also wants to uphold uttama bhakti. And he's doing both simultaneously without disturbing people in either mentality. And the devotees who understand this, they're appreciating and accepting the Lord's mercy in whatever way the Lord wants to give it without disturbing the Lord's plan, and they do so by being happy as menial servants. So such a nice pastime. Such wonderful relationship between the Lord and Maharaj Prajaparudra. Once at the Govardhan retreat, Burajan Prabhu gave a whole 4 or 5 days just on this relationship between Mahaprabhu and King Prajaparudra. So we could go very deep into their particular relationship. And any time we look at this relationship between the Lord and any of his devotees, we can learn so much about how we want to relate to the Lord. So we have about 2 or 3 minutes. Any questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions, chastisements? Yes, Prabhu.
The different levels of service and moods, and you use the analogy of the kindergarten up to the 12th grade. It's interesting because on the one hand, that's kind of understandable, but on the other hand, on a practical experience level, we see that quite often the bigger the brain materially, the more difficult it is for people to understand the relationship between the Lord and his devotee. Like, I'm speaking specifically of Srila Prabhupada and in our movement. And I'm not expecting you to answer here. This is a seminar you should give sometime. How the phenomenon that the bigger the brain materially, the more difficult it is for devotees to understand and appreciate the perfection of Prabhupada's relationship with Krishna. They actually dare to criticize Prabhupada and things that he did and said and wrote. And so to me, it's very interesting how the more materially intelligent people are, and I'm not naming anybody specifically. I think you know as well as I do, there are many. The more materially intelligent they are, the more difficult it is for them to understand that everything that Srila Prabhupada did was perfect. I have to keep repeating this. If you accept that Prabhupada is a pure devotee, everything he did was perfect. Everything he said was perfect. Everything he wrote was perfect. It may not sit in your craw because of your psychophysical makeup and where you are materially, but everything he did was perfect because he was doing exactly what you said. He was playing a role that Krishna wanted him to play, and he was playing it perfectly.
And he was preaching on many different levels. Sometimes at a particular place he's just preaching at one level. Sometimes another place he's just preaching on another level. Sometimes he's preaching on many levels simultaneously. And there's always layers that you can find. And we'd say, yes, everything Srila Prabhupada did and said was perfect for that context and for his purpose. It's like if you took Mahaprabhu's activity of not seeing Maharaj Prajaparudra as he's making some sort of absolute universal statement for all levels. That wouldn't be correct. And if you take Mahaprabhu's dealing with King Prajaparudra in the Gundicha Garden in that way, that wouldn't be correct either. They each have a different purpose and they're nuanced. And one of my examples of this is that Srila Prabhupada, I believe it's in the 8th chapter, where he talks about how one can fix his mind on any incarnation of Krishna, Ram, Nisinga, Lislam. And then the 18th chapter, he says, you shouldn't fix your mind. You shouldn't even divert your attention, he says. So you should fix your mind only on Krishna with two hands playing his flute and do not divert your attention to any other form. So how can you fix your mind on a form to which you cannot divert your attention? You can't. So those two purports appear to be completely contradictory. You basically cannot literally follow the instructions of one purport and literally follow the instructions of the other. But if you understand that Srila Prabhupada is speaking in different moods at different levels, that one instruction is suitable for people at one level and the other instruction is suitable for persons at another level. So they're both perfect instructions and they're both absolutely true, but they're absolutely true at different levels. And this is the way Krishna speaks also. Just like Krishna speaks to Arjuna and he says, for those who have been honored, dishonor is worse than death. You know, fight for honor. And then he goes ahead and says, don't fight for honor. This is fight without considering honor or dishonor. Wait a minute. First you told me that I should worry about being honored. And now you tell me I shouldn't worry about being honored. So both those things are true. They're both true. They're both absolutely true. And it depends on your mentality. Now, just like we may say to somebody that, well, if you eat meat, you're more likely to get cancer and so many things. We may give a materialistic argument why to be a vegetarian. But that's not why we're vegetarians. So, yes, I see that everything that Prabhupada says and everything that Krishna says, everything Mahaprabhu says and does is perfect. And one always has to understand the context. Otherwise, you have, you know, Krishna speaking to his father and saying, why are you worshiping God? Don't worship God. Everything's just dependent on your karma. And if you say, well, you know, we're going to reject that. But that also has validity, depending on what your level is. As far as what you say about the bigger brain you have, not quite sure how to respond to that. I'm thinking of how to respond to it, but I'm afraid to. In the Queen Kunti's prayer, she talks about those who are attached to material opulences, which are good birth, money, intelligence. And Prabhupada, in giving a lecture on that, says those are all zeros, but if you add one, then they're valuable. So if you have a big, anyone here has a big brain, you do not have to get a lobotomy. Okay, that wasn't the point of the comment, right? Okay. You don't have to go drink a lot of alcohol and kill all your brain cells so that then you can understand Krishna. So if you have a big brain, fine, just put one in front of it. Make it a 10. Well, that's not, what does Krishna say? The first item of knowledge is humility. So as soon as we think we know, whether your brain's big or small, but as soon as we think we know, then you can't learn anything. That was one of my mantras to my students. You know, sometimes the kids come up and they say, why are we doing this? And you say, do you want to know or do you want to argue? You know, if somebody wants to argue, it's useless. There's no point. Someone always thinks, so I used to teach my students a mantra that whenever you're sure you're right, say, I might be wrong. In your mind, I might be wrong. I might be wrong. Because once I'm talking to my son, and I was saying something really strongly, and he said, Mata, are you sure you're right? I said, I'm sure. He said, 100% sure? And I stopped. Well, maybe not. So to have in your mind this little voice, make it say, maybe I'm wrong. And then you go to the other person and say, I'm confused. So one of the things I'm learning as I'm approaching old age is that I'm often wrong. That I really don't know anything. It's such a happy place to be. It's such a relief to not have to pretend to know anything anymore. So to have imperfect senses, cheating propensity, illusions, make mistakes, that all applies to me, that I'm a grade A number one fool, and boy, is that such a relief. To not have to, you know, have this false facade that I know anything and I can understand anything. You know, of course, when we're preaching to the atheists, we don't act like that. When we're preaching to the atheists, we act as if we know everything, because they don't appreciate humility. But that was just like when I first read in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila chapter 7, Lord Chaitanya in 5 features. It first came out as a separate book, so I devoured it and practically speaking memorized it. I was a very new devotee. And then that Sunday, at the Sunday feast, there was this Indian gentleman who was preaching Mayavad philosophy.